This is Functional Medicine Update for September 2011, Volume 31, Number 11. This month we'll continue with the second portion of the panel discussion we brought you in last month's issue. But before we do that, Dr. Bland will be addressing the question, what is lifestyle medicine? We begin by covering the basic principles, and next consider mental health as a chronic disease. We will explore the financial aspects of nutritionally based treatment. We'll ask the $45 trillion question. We'll consider the molecular origins of chronic disease and the impact of epigenetic modulation to affect the restoration of health. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland with the November 2011 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for November 2011. This is the continuation of a theme that we initiated in the October issue, which I'm very excited about, which is this roundtable forum that we orchestrated on lifestyle medicine. What is lifestyle medicine? How is it applied in the clinic? What's its point of differentiation from traditional preventive medicine? Does it have value reducing the burden of chronic disease and turning back early stages of pathology associated with various chronic illnesses? Those are the questions that were raised during this forum. And before we get into the completion of the discussion among the resident expert physicians that were present for this forum that we had in Gig Harbor, Washington a month or so ago, I'd like to set the context as to why I think this is an appropriate theme in this period of time in the evolution of the functional medicine model. And I think what I'm going to say for most of you is well known, but it never hurts to have a refresher, kind of reinforcement for basic principles that underlie the work that we're engaged in every day as it pertains to healthcare delivery. This comes from a recent World Economic Forum on healthcare that was talking about how do we improve the state of the world and the people that reside in the world. And this particular 2011 year, the forum met specifically to look at healthcare-related issues pertaining to the global economy. The results of this were truly, I think, remarkable for those of us who have been living through the global economic disaster of the last few years without precedent in our lives since the Great Depression. We have been experiencing, both in the United States and in the global economic community, these wide swings, almost whipsaw-like swings in the economy and how that ultimately influences the lives of people on the so-called trickle-down model to the daily ability to maintain status both in the developed and the developing world. So the question as to how this all interrelates with healthcare and the prevalence of certain diseases is not an esoteric or tangential topic. It's really at the cornerstone of understanding how the world community is going to meet the challenges that lie ahead, in that an unhealthy population, which is burdened with chronic disease, cannot mobilize the kinds of necessary focus on building an economic model of success that may be required under a time of great global financial turmoil. So with that in mind, what's the global economic impact of the five leading non-communicable diseases? I'm not even going to go into the HIV or influenza or other communicable types of diseases like tuberculosis and malaria. I'm just going to talk about the non-communicable diseases, the leading chronic age-related degenerative diseases, cardiovascular disease, chronic respiratory disease, cancer, diabetes, and mental health issues, including Alzheimer's disease. The results of this forum, in terms of looking at that from a global perspective, was, I think, overwhelming, because the suggestion was that these particular diseases, these five diseases, could mean for the global impact to our economy about $47 trillion over the next 20 years, $47 trillion, which means that this deficit that we have gotten the United States into of a couple of trillion dollars would pale in comparison to the depth of the hole that the burden of chronic disease will make on the global economy over the next 20 years. The Global Economic Burden of Noncommunicable Diseases reports analyzes the overall costs of these noncommunicable diseases to the global economy, and what it suggests is it represents about 4% of the annual global GDP is going to have to be dedicated to maintenance of therapeutics related to the rising tide of these diseases. Historically, mental health was left off the list of the top noncommunicable diseases, but as a consequence of the rising tide of Alzheimer's in the aging population, when you add that to the list, it accounts for more than $16 trillion, or one-third of the $47 trillion anticipated. So if we were to look at where we see the greatest growth of concerns and the lack of good therapeutics in this area of chronic illness, it appears it's in the chronic mental health area, particularly Alzheimer's and dementia-related. More than 60% of deaths worldwide are due to the noncommunicable diseases. Low and middle income families are disproportionately affected, as we've talked about in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. And you recall we, about 10 years ago, cited the studies looking at poverty as one of the most significant risk factors to disease. And we said that poverty from this study was more than just annual income. It was related to feeling impoverished, which was low attribution, lack of acceptance of value, lack of love and appreciation, lack of meaning in life, that this broader definition of poverty or being impoverished correlated very strongly with early stage disease and death, even in the absence of traditional risk factors, the so-called Framingham risk factors. So there are many different components that relate to the rising burden of disease, including isolation, lack of attribution, and, in quote, poverty. In 2010, 80% of the noncommunicable disease deaths occurred in the countries, many of them prematurely at working age, actually taking people out of the workforce and reducing their ability to contribute to the overall economic growth or even economic stability of their countries. The global population beyond the age of 60, as you know, is expected to double between now and 2050. This development, coupled with increasing urbanization, means a sharp increase in the noncommunicable disease rates. And the study concludes that the cumulative basis of cardiovascular disease, chronic respiratory disease, cancer and diabetes in low and middle income countries are estimated to surpass $7 trillion in the years 2011 to 2025. So we're seeing a very, very significant change in what we might consider lifestyle-related diseases, lifestyle environment. This interaction between genes and environment and lifestyle that gives rise to a change in the function of the organism that we later stage diagnosis of disease. So is there an economic argument then for a functional medicine intervention earlier with, we might say, pre-clinical signs of disease, meaning a trajectory towards disease, functional decrements in performance of the individual as measured by changes in biomarkers or psychometric performance or physical performance that indicates a premature acceleration of loss of function associated with biological age? These are very important questions that are now really at the cornerstone of trying to address how we're going to fight back against this $47 trillion expected cost to chronic disease globally over the next 20 years. And that takes us to a very nice editorial that appeared recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled A Closer Look at the Economic Argument for Disease Prevention. This marries itself very nicely to the functional medicine, patient-centered assessment, personalized medicine approach. It goes on to say that disease prevention has always been the preferred option for promoting health and reducing disease rates. This health argument is the reason why people have suggested that we should be investing in prevention. Others, however, have criticized us, saying that there's no really great long-term outcome study saying that one would be able to save a measurable amount of money in healthcare expenses by engaging in prevention. And so it lacks a proof of concept that preventive services will actually result in these savings as a consequence of improved health benefits over time. So these outcome studies are really kind of pivotal in people making a decision that the best way to spend dollars is on the early stage of intervention with preclinical disease and prognosis rather than diagnosis. as watchwords for intervention. So the question as to whether prevention saves money has been incorrectly framed, according to Dr. Wolf in his editorial. He says healthcare, like other goods, is not purchased to save money. The dollar can be stretched further. More goods can be acquired by optimizing economic value. The proper question for preventive intervention is how much health the investment purchases. This is measured generally in terms of cost effectiveness or cost utility, which in healthcare, as you know, is quality of life years. So we might ask, what is the quality of adjusted life years that you would get by a prevention strategy for a particular disease versus waiting till it's diagnosed and you do an intervention? So we could say cardiovascular disease prevention, meaning functional medicine improvement of cardiovascular function versus waiting till you have cardiac pathology and intervening with a hospital-based or an interventional therapy. And how do the quality of adjusted life years relate between these two approaches? And those types of data are now starting to come available. Services that are ordinarily considered to have reasonable cost effectiveness in the interventional model are between $50,000 to $75,000 per quality adjusted life year. But payers from the insurance world will routinely cover treatments that cost more than $100,000 per quality adjusted life year. So that's kind of the benchmark that you could use to then compare functional preventive or functional early interventional studies against and say if you can have data that would allow you to understand the cost of a functional medicine intervention and its relationship to quality adjusted life years, and compare that to the benchmark of a pathophysiologically based intervention model, which is between $50,000 and $100,000 per quality of life adjusted years, you could then form some kind of an understanding of cost effectiveness or benefit. So that's a very interesting way of approaching it. And as Dr. Wolf points out, in order to do that, we might start looking at several kind of specific things that would pertain to this. First of all, what type of services are we talking about in terms of measuring early intervention versus late intervention? Are we talking about a public health intervention, which has to do with things like seatbelts, mammography, low cholesterol diets, or are we dealing with personalized intervention trials that relate to the individual needs of a patient-centered approach? Number two, what evidence are we going to use for determining our quality of life, adjusted life year outcomes? The evidence-based clinical services needs to have objective markers for tracking benefit because the outcome that we're going to use is not going to be the endpoint called death. We're going to use something that are more functional decrements. So will we use biomarkers like cholesterol to HDL ratios, or will we use carotid intimal medial thickness levels, or will we use cardiac performance on a treadmill test? Will we use some type of imagery of wall motion studies? All sorts of different variables might be considered important for determining how we're going to objectively measure the quality of adjusted life years for our intervention by maybe surrogate markers that are tracked against longer-term outcome variables that have to do with things like life expectancy. And then next is, what is a core set of services that will be delivered? Is there some kind of a reasonable, replicable protocol that we can implement both in terms of screening, in other words, a set, a portfolio of evaluative tools that are tied then to the outcome treatment that we're going to employ in these preventive functional medicine focused services. And I think that when you start adding this all together, it starts to form a system or a schema, so to speak, that would allow us to both have a replicable way of intervening in a more functional medicine early stage preclinical milieu, and then have ways of evaluating outcome and look at cost effectiveness from quality of adjusted life year comparisons with more pathology-based interventions. And I think that's the way that this field is evolving. If we're going to actually demonstrate at a large regulatory level, legislative level, reimbursement level, these types of data need to be accumulated so that we can actually sit down and measure apples against apples in terms of cost, benefit, and outcome-related studies, and what is the economic value for this personalized lifestyle medicine approach. So this has to do a little bit then with finding the right therapy and how that gets personalized appropriately. Recently, an article that I authored entitled Finding the Right Therapy, A Look at Personalized Medicine, appeared in the Integrative Medicine Clinicians Journal, in which I talked about how this whole theme had evolved since the turn of the last century with the concept of biochemical individuality through Archibald Garrod's discussion of genetic metabolism diseases, moved into Roger Williams and Linus Pauling with biochemical individuality, genotrophic disease, and orthomolecular medicine, and has now moved into the post-genomic era with regard to the deciphering of the code of the human genome, and then into gene expression understandings and how we recognize that the genome in and of itself is not the ultimate determinant of our phenotype, but rather it's the interaction of the genetic code, meaning our genome, our book of life, 23 chapters encoded in our 23 pairs of chromosomes, how those stories in our book of life called our genes are ultimately expressed as a consequence of the interaction with our environment. And those personal environmental exposures then give rise to different expression patterns that ultimately become our phenotype, how we look, act, feel, and what our health process, how it evolves over the course of living. With that in mind, we then see the emergence of a concept that really is a revisited concept from the 1800s, and it's the concept of adaptation, because it's not just the determinism of the genes as they're hardwired from our parental legacy, the sperm and the egg when they met, but it's also the influence that our environment has had on setting marks on those genetic codes that then allow different expression patterns to pursue. And this is the process that's called epigenetics, as we've talked about in length in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. You recall the magnificent discussions we've had, and two occasions actually, with Dr. Randy Jertl at Duke, kind of the father of nutritional epigenetics, and the discussion we have with Dr. Michael Skinner at Washington State University on Functional Medicine Update that talked about exposure in the environment to various substances that are toxins that induce epigenetic marks on the germ cells and alter then the function of subsequent generations. And he talked about transgenerational inheritance of those epigenetic marks into the third generation. So we're starting to see a revalidation of what John Baptiste was talking about in the 1800s as it relates to adaptation, which now is being seen at the molecular genetic level as epigenetics, these methylated stop functions or silencing of gene functions or the phosphorylation or the acetylation or the ubiquitination of genes that are all post-translational effects that occur epigenetically to put these marks on the genome that allow only certain messages to be expressed and others to be silenced. So we're actually witnessing the bridge between the environment and the genome through epigenetics. And that takes us then to the question as to what role does nutrition play in this epigenetic understanding. In the past, we might have felt that nutrition was a third or fourth level variable that had very little to do with how our health proceeded as we grew older and was relegated in medicine to a spot way at the back of the class. Recently, however, as Randy Jertl's discoveries have now been validated and many, many other investigators are starting to look at the role that nutrients have in epigenetic influences on gene expression, it's starting to be seen that this epigenetic concept may represent a bridge between nutrition and the phenotype of health or disease. We now recognize that nutrients can reverse or change epigenetic phenomena, such as DNA methylation and histone modifications within the genome, thereby modifying the expression of critical genes associated with physiologic and pathologic processes. It includes such things as embryonic development, aging, and even carcinogenesis. And in fact, there are individuals who have questioned whether epigenesis is in part related to the increasing frequency of such conditions as autistic spectrum disorder in our society. Could it be that altered methylation patterns caused by changes in fetal stress that are seen in utero, and that stress could be chemical stress or a variety of different inputs that would then alter the way the imprinting of the genome occurred during fetal development and change then ultimately the expression patterns of the genome into the phenotype that we call ASD, Autistic Spectrum Disorder. This has been a very robust area of inquiry and research over the last several years. we now recognize that we might be able to say that many of our chronic age-related degenerative diseases are in part epigenetic in origin. And as was recently talked about, these might be considered long latency nutritional disorders, as contrasted to short latency nutritional disorders like scurvy, beriberi, pellagra, xerothalmia, and rickets, where you can omit or prohibit the intake of a certain vitamin for a short period of time, like vitamin C, and you can induce in the matter of weeks to months, you can induce scurvy in a human. But what happens if the alteration of a nutrient intake has a much longer timeline in its effect on epigenetic modulation, ultimately of gene expression, and then the sequence of events that lead into pathology, so that it's not just weeks or months, but it's years or decades in which that starts to be seen? How does a person know the origin of that disease, say cardiac disease, when the origin occurred as a consequence of the accumulative influence of epigenetic changes on the genome over years of living? It might have started actually in utero and then been continually re-stimulated through the environment that that individual was living to ultimately encourage then the outcome that we call this chronic disease, which may be thought to have no nutritional relationship, but really if we knew its etiology from the initiation through its progression, we would see it's a functional outcome of an early stage epigenetic change. These are the questions that are being asked as it relates to the importance of nutrition and its relationship to epigenetics. It appears that nutrients and bioactive food components, which includes things like phytochemicals, this rich array of thousands of different secondary metabolites of plants that are unique in their ability to modulate cellular communication, that they influence epigenetic phenomena either directly or indirectly by influencing enzymes that catalyze DNA methylation or histone modifications, or by altering the availability of substrates necessary for these enzymatic reactions. The one that we've probably heard the most about recently is the so-called sirtuin gene family that regulate aspects of histone acetylation, deacetylation, and therefore the folding and unfolding of the genome to be accessible to reader enzymes. And you probably know that this marries itself very closely to what we call the French paradox, where it's been said that people in France eating a traditional high-fat but natural French diet and drinking red wine have a very low incidence of cardiovascular disease. When they consume a more highly processed diet that's less natural and contains less phytochemicals, their incidence of cardiovascular disease goes up. So the suggestion is that fat in and of itself is not the causative agent, but rather it's the kind of diet that brings information that alters the expression of genes that in the absence of those nutrients then results in pathology. So French paradox, red wine, resveratrol, it gave birth to the increasing ordering at restaurants of red wine. It was wonderful for the red wine business because everyone said, oh yeah, I'm drinking red wine for the health value now for these phytochemicals. Well, the resveratrol story is a very fascinating story, is a concept that lies within this epigenetic theme that is emerging, nutritional epigenetics. Because resveratrol is just one of many phytochemicals that have been identified to modulate various aspects of genome structure and function in an epigenetic way. Resveratrol has been shown to influence the regulation of function of the SIRT1 gene in mammalian cells, eukaryotic mammalian cells, and as a consequence it leads to alteration in histone deacetylase, one of the enzymes that's responsible for taking off acetyl groups from the histone proteins, which then allows these proteins to open up and to, say, read here, to translate the message of that gene into messenger RNA, ultimately into protein. And so this particular phytochemical, resveratrol, is one of a family, a literally large family of specific plant-derived materials which influence genetic structure and function in such a way as to alter the phenotype, meaning alter the communication in that cell that produces its function. This is a very dramatic shift in our thinking, isn't it, about diet, to think that somehow there are information molecules within our food that can influence specific regions in a very tailored, lasered way, the regions of expression of genes by epigenetic modulation of their structure function. Epigenetic mean above the actual code itself. We're not altering the ATGC pairing in the DNA code, they remain constant. What we are changing is the way that that code can be read, either by silencing the genome, by allowing certain messages not to be read, or prohibiting them from being read, or activating certain other genomic messages to be read by acetylation, for instance, which is known to open the genome to being read. So these are very, very interesting changes in how we view the interrelationship between diet and ultimately function and health of the individual. So could there be the emergence of treatments that could be focused on either prevention or dietary management of specific epigenetically modified functions that give rise to what we see later stage, this long latency disease like cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes or cancer or arthritis? And of course, the emerging understanding of this field seems to suggest that yes, that's where the data is taking us. In fact, there's a very interesting review paper that was published recently on this whole topic in the Advances of Nutrition in 2010, page 8, that talks about this bridge between nutrition and health as connected to epigenetics and nutrient modulations of epigenetics. It once again talks about how these phytochemicals in food can modulate intracellular signal transduction, meaning alter the way the environment speaks to genes to regulate the gene expression. This particular epigenetic revolution that's occurring goes beyond just things like methylation and acetylation of the genome. It moves itself also into another topic that we discussed previously 2 years ago in Functional Medicine Update that for many was probably very esoteric and seemed to have little clinical application. And that was an interview with the primary investigator at the Scripps Institute on the small inducible inhibitory RNAs. And you recall, if you go back with me for a moment, that he indicated that what is being seen in cells, that there are literally thousands of differing RNA molecules that are produced specifically by a cell, many of which have unique inhibitory functions on the expression of genes. They're like blocking RNA fragments from the ability to read specific messages. So this is another part of the epigenetic regulatory pathways, that cells are producing these jamming messages that prevent specific regions of the genome from being read. Now, clearly, we're still witnessing the emergence of understanding of how inhibitory RNAs actually play roles in physiology. But there is big research project going on at many different institutions now to find out how to harness specific siRNAs, small inhibitory RNAs, to block the production of certain oncogenic proteins associated with cancer. So this is being seen as a potential new route towards cancer treatment by modulating cellular function at the siRNA level. The interesting theme of this is that these small inducible inhibitory RNAs are also produced by plants in their regulatory machinery. It's not just seen in human cells. And these small inducible RNAs have just recently, in 2011, been found to be consumed in the diet of plant foods and have been found, at least in the case of rice, small inhibitory RNAs, to actually be seen in the blood after consumption of rice, meaning that these microRNAs actually can survive digestion and end up being transferred across the GI barrier into the blood, and therefore may have influence, and I want to emphasize may, have influence on modulating through an epigenetic mechanism that occurs through the diet, the expression of certain genes in the host organism that's consumed that food. Now, this is a pretty dramatic observation, isn't it? Because what it's saying is we're getting information from food that could potentially modulate gene expression through a inhibitory mechanism that's specific to regions of the genome that would alter health or disease patterns. Let me, if I can, once again cite this article. The title of the article is quite esoteric. Exogenous plant miRNA 168 specifically targets mammalian LDL receptor AP1, and there is evidence from this study of cross-kingdom regulation by these microRNAs, and this appeared in the journal Cell Research in 2011, page 1 through 20. This is... it's pretty amazing, really. Previous studies from this group had demonstrated that stable microRNAs or miRNAs, inhibitory RNAs, in mammalian serum plasma are actively secreted from tissues and cells and can serve as a novel class of biomarkers for diseases, and they act as signaling molecules in intracellular communication at an epigenetic level. In this particular paper, however, they went on to report what I think is an absolutely fascinating finding, that the exogenous plant miRNAs, these small microinhibitory RNAs, are present in the serum and tissues, and I want to emphasize tissues, of various animals that have orally consumed these plants, and that those exogenous small inhibitory RNAs are primarily acquired orally through food intake. The specific example that was chosen in this study was this small inducible microRNA 168A. It's abundant in rice and is one of the most highly enriched exogenous plant microRNAs in the sera as found in Chinese subjects consuming rice. Functional studies asking, does this have any role to play in gene expression, when they did the in vitro functional studies and in vivo, demonstrated these microRNA 168A could bind a human mouse low-density lipoprotein receptor adapter protein, or so-called LDL-RAP1, inhibiting then the expression in the liver and consequently decreasing LDL removal from the mouse plasma. These findings, they suggest, demonstrate that exogenous plant microinhibitory RNAs in food can regulate the expression of target genes in mammals. Now let me let that set in just for a second. You want to talk about a shifting paradigm? This is one. This has us really looking at diet and food and relationship with information and gene expression and how that translates out into non-communicable chronic disease in a very, very remarkable way. And in fact, it even suggests that epigenetic changes are not just hardwired. They can come and go based upon the type of dietary intake a person has and the presence and exposure to these microinhibitory RNAs in their food. So what can we say about this extraordinary discovery? Investigators at the Max Planck Institute of Developmental Biology in Germany really have discovered what might be the first comprehensive inventory of how spontaneous epigenetic changes can be brought about through food, and that these could be considered reversible as diets change, which means that epigenetic changes may not always last. They may come and go as it relates to the changing diets of the individual. Now, if you tie this together with my previous discussion concerning phytochemicals that influence the genomic structure, like resveratrol with SIRT2N1 genes, you're starting to see that this regulatory series of pathways that ultimately regulate how genes are expressed and ultimately become our phenotype is much more related to environmental factors than we previously have acknowledged. And therefore, the concept of a personalized lifestyle medicine intervention program that's functionally based is starting to have a molecular genetic and a cell biological explanation that is absolutely profoundly intelligent when we start asking the question, how, why, when, and what do we do? We're really starting to develop a new medicine that then translates ultimately up into, doesn't it, studies that would allow us to look at cost-effectiveness of personalized intervention early stage based on certain new emerging biomarkers, and then ultimately tracking that against quality of adjusted life years so that we start to see those who are planning health economies and health expenditures and are really trying to deal with the broad brush questions of $47 trillion to be spent for the next 20 years on non-communicable chronic diseases, how this could move the needle, how this could improve outcome. I was very impressed when I looked at a recent paper that appeared in the journal Cell, which is one of the premier high-quality journals in the area of cellular biology, in which they reported in a very nice study of the influence of 30 days of supplementation of resveratrol on metabolic parameters and body fat in obese humans. This is a very interesting study that appeared in volume 14, page 612, in 2011, November 2011, in which resveratrol, this the same compound I was talking about, is a constituent of grapes, in grape skins, which is known from previous studies to affect energy metabolism and mitochondrial function, and it's been suggested to serve as a calorie restriction mimetic, and themes that we've talked about earlier. And we interviewed, as you recall, Dr. Christoph Westfall, the CEO of Certrus Pharma years ago, before they were acquired by GlaxoSmithKline, who had really been exploiting the discoveries of David Sinclair at Harvard related to resveratrol and the SIRT1 gene. In this particular paper, they treated 11 healthy obese men with a placebo and 150 milligrams per day of a special form of bioavailable resveratrol in a randomized double-blind crossover study for 30 days. What they found after the 30 days with this 11 groups of individuals that were randomized, that resveratrol was found to significantly reduce sleeping and resting metabolic rate. In muscle, resveratrol was found to activate adenosine monophosphate kinase, or AMPK, which is kind of the energy thermostat of the cell. You recall we've talked about it previously as having a direct effect on mitochondrial oxidative energy production, bioenergetics. It was found to increase SIRT1 expression and increase citrate synthase activity without change in mitochondrial content, and improve muscle mitochondrial respiration on a fatty acid-derived substrate. It was also seen that resveratrol was found to modulate or influence intramyocellular lipid levels, and it decreased intrahepatic lipid content, meaning lowered fat infiltration into the liver, and it lowered circulating glucose, triglycerides, and liver enzymes like ALT, and it also reduced inflammatory markers like hsCRP. So this was a very interesting study in humans, and again, I want to suggest that this was a early stage type trial. We're only talking about 11 healthy obese men randomized between resveratrol and placebo, with the resveratrol being 150 milligrams per day of this unique formulation of resveratrol that was made more bioavailable. By the way, 150 milligrams a day would be equivalent to, something like 70 glasses of wine. So we're talking about an amount that is more pharmacologic and less nutritional, because you're not going to pick up 150 milligrams in a food and beverage delivery system under normal conditions. So in that nutritional pharmacological intervention with resveratrol in these modestly obese, presumably healthy individuals, it appeared to have very salutary and beneficial effects on modulating expression that ultimately was seen as lowered triglyceride, lowered inflammatory markers, lowered glucose, and improved liver function. So I think that these are very, very exciting clinical takeaways from the discussion we're having concerning, does nutritional epigenomics and genetics really play a role, or is it more of an esoteric academic topic as it pertains to the burden of disease and the rising tide of chronic non-communicable diseases in the world? How does that relate then to this discussion among the experts that you're going to hear in the remainder of this issue of Functional Medicine Update? It really relates directly to the question of the efficacy of a functional medicine approach towards personalized lifestyle intervention. Does it really deliver the goods? Is it more than just a feel-good experience? Does it have an outcome that really can reduce the progression to more serious pathology? Will it be cost-effective? Will it increase the quality of adjusted life years of the individuals? All of these are very, very important questions that appear to me, from the way that the literature is emerging and how things are being developed, to have a revolutionary conceptual affirmation for this model. In fact, recently, the group that I'm very privileged to work with at a Functional Medicine Clinical Research Center just published a paper in Nutrition Research, volume 31, page 347 in 2011, reporting on the role of a complex phytochemical formulation that contained hops, isoalpha acids, berberine, and vitamin D3 and vitamin K, having a very profound and favorable effect on bone biomarker profiles in postmenopausal women who have metabolic syndrome. That this particular study demonstrated that by giving a certain concentrated mixture of bioactive phytonutrients that are known to influence certain gene expression patterns, that you actually can enhance the osteogenic potential within certain cells that would help to prevent bone loss and help to maintain proper bone integrity. So we're talking here about more than just giving calcium and vitamin D to mineralize bone. We're really talking about the active process of bone formation and bone resorption that balance between osteogenesis and osteolysis, and how that triggering event of that equilibrium is in part controlled by the environmental exposure to certain phytochemicals that can modulate the gene expression patterns. This is sometimes called hormesis, as we've talked about in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. A small amounts of the right things hitting certain regulatory nodes on the gene expression patterns can have a larger effect clinically than we would have predicted, hormesis. So these concepts of berberine and vitamin D and vitamin K and rhoisoalpha acids from hops having unique gene personalities to enhance the orchestration of the phenotype of cells that are associated with bone integrity maintenance is, I think, another of the myriad of examples that are coming out in the literature recently as it pertains to improvement of function with the appropriate information from food. So it's food, exercise, stress management, the reduction of exposure to environmental xenobiotics or chemicals, heavy toxic elements, all these things then play extraordinary roles in sending signals to cells that ultimately create expression patterns that become the phenotype and then later appear as these population-based increases in non-communicable disease incidence that cost $47 trillion to manage over the next 20 years. That's kind of wrapping this all together as to why this discussion with our board of experts, this extraordinary group of dedicated individuals, is, I think, so important as we move into the next features of our healthcare economy. And with that, let's move to the discussion with this dedicated group of clinician experts.
I've got two last questions I want to ask each of you, and they can be probably fairly short answers, but the first one, which comes up frequently in conversations I have with individuals who may be considering integrating a portion of lifestyle medicine into their practice, is, what are my peers going to think of me? I mean, this is a guild. Medicine is a guild. It's really a pass down from the Medici family in Italy, and it's had generations of refinement, but it's still a very strong guild of internecting communications. So what happens when you start breaking the guild, and how does that have an impact on you and your life and your vision and your identity? Maybe it could be none, but my experience is it's generally something. So, David, I'll start with you.
Well, I wondered about that question because it wasn't lifestyle changes in my clinic included doing home births with midwives, and Ashland is a small town of 18,000, but we're right next to the large referral center. So you have no idea how people think about you. So I go merrily along my way, delivering babies at home and going about doing lifestyle medicine, and eventually we got into what we call functional medicine. So managed care comes along, and all the doctors are scared because they can sit with a patient and make decisions about that patient that's a life and death decision. But when it comes to confronting an insurance company that holds your purse, your money purse, somehow I've never seen such changes. I mean, it was a bipolar experience for me watching how doctors dealt with managed care. They actually came to me to be their president, to help them with the insurance companies. Because somewhere in there they realized they're going to ask us to do something about prevention. And we don't know anything about prevention, and David, we'd like you to come. It surprised me, because I thought I was considered more radical than that. I mean, to have that kind of respect in a community when you think of yourself as, well, that Dr. Jones over there on Ashland, he's pretty weird. So I had exactly the opposite experience, that making decisions about my patients, the way that I referred patients and what patients said about me when they went to. Now, I had other doctors in the community that came out of medical school, and they were just so, they felt such a sense of betrayal that they created a certain disharmony between the establishment and themselves. And for whatever reason, I had such great respect for the skills that I could refer my patients to people with skills in areas, but I also knew what not to take from their advice. And over time, there was a respect that was developed, and I was their president for 10 years until I came and was asked to be the president of IFM. So I didn't have a bad experience being a granola doctor in Ashland.
But I think you said something very, very important, and I've observed this not only with you, but other very successful people that swing over this and have feet in multiple areas of activity, and that is you really created a relationship with your community of respect. You never passed a sense of disrespect for people that did things differently. In fact, you honored their skills in areas where you needed them, didn't look through their liabilities and limitations as the major barrier. And I think that's a really important lesson because, as you said, there are some people who get in this field, they have the conversion experience. And then everything that they did before was wrong, and all the people in that field are wrong, and suddenly we end up with a polarity, and now it's a fight. So, Graham, how about you? You've made this transition from Oakland Raiders team doctor all the way up through the years of dealing with a myriad of different medical referral specialists. How's it been for you?
Well, a couple of things. I'm a nut about leadership reading, and I love the stuff that Einstein said, that what the solutions are you had that brought you to the solution to the problem of today are not necessarily applicable to the problem you have tomorrow. So the issue is that we've got to continue to have a dynamic of change and not be caught up in finding out what the next thing current therapy says we should do. But we should also not ignore that, but we should live in it and past it. So it's easy to do one thing, I think, in medicine, that we fail to embrace the system that parented us. Your own, ours, it parented us. If we disrespect it, then you run a risk of now feeling as though others really can't associate with you because they're frightened about this. So I end up doing this. I gather consultants around me that I often has a phrase, Covey says, every breakthrough must first start with a break with. And that's a vital part of everything we do. Every breakthrough is going to start with a break with. But it doesn't mean break with things out there that you've been trained in. It means break with their control over you. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily do, but break with that yourself. And the big thing about who's the person that we have to fix most? It's me in the mirror. That's me. I've got to fix me first. And then the next thing I think is that I have a phrase of patients that the difference between good and excellent care could be the miles in your car. And I really don't care much about it. I'm sorry about that. The gas is high. I know that. But the point is, I'm going to find you the very best consultant I'm going to do. So, as I have a nurse practitioner of 27 consultants that she will, in the next 4 months, come to see. And they'll be here. They'll be around. She'll be with Deanna. I'll be out there to the office. But they will become an integrated part, and they will know that. And so my orthopedist, which I sent 380 patients to a few group in Seattle because I had so many. But with the 600 MRs and CTs, because by the time they get to us, they're already pretty damaged and they have been cared for. So in that regard, those people already know how I think. And they'll come back and say, go back to Graham because he knows how to fix this food for you. Because if you don't do the food, you won't get better. Because what you're doing is you go home and you've gained all this weight, and now you got this knee, and you want me to fix the knee. I can't do a darn thing about your knee unless I can cut and fix it. But it will not make you well. I can't make you. But Graham can, and he'll listen to people. And so those are the people we gather around us. And they become both purveyors of the truth, in my mind, and our truth. It's a shared truth. It's not one that comes from me. It's one that's given out easily. And I'll say, you get to go see one of the best guys that I know, one of the best gals I know. And you get to do this. And I'll pick up the phone in front of him, call, say, Scott, this is who I've got. His kid's been at this, he's coming in today, he's got 4.5 weeks in ankle today. His little therapist said, doctor said he could play a few weeks ago, but he's having a hard time walking. And he was dead, so he comes in. And this is this fun part. Somebody said, who referred you? And he said, all the coaches in the area. Anyway. In that, I said, well, the problem is you have a little chip fracture. We did the digital x-ray, saw the x-ray, saw tournament, showed dad and said, you can play tomorrow. And this is what the braces is for, and this is why. And because, but you will not be good. So you have to cheat as a wide receiver and a defensive back. You have to stay on the left side. So you play at this end. You do not get out in the middle. If you don't do this, you can't play. But you go act like everything's fine. You're just fine. Just stay on the left side. Tell the coach, I don't do anything right side because I'm not good. And go tackle all you want. But the guy goes on your left, you're dead. So, and we do that in basketball, we do it in volleyball. We do, and the point is you become a participant in their life. You become a participant in their sport. And they all of a sudden know you know what I'm talking about. If you're playing tennis, don't rush the net. Stay on the and I'm getting too carried away. But anyway, that's it's for living in their life with them that I think is a big problem.
Beautiful.
Jay, how about you? You've transcended many different boundaries. Anything that you would offer as kind of your observations?
A few points come to mind. One is that I like to see more of the kind of research that we heard about earlier today and see having controlled double-blind studies. I know it's very difficult to sort of contextualize functional medicine or lifestyle medicine in terms of a clinical study, but we really have to do it because in order to effect change and allow ourselves to adopt these important principles, we're going to have to show the research that it does matter, even though that we know that it does matter. And I think that there's obviously a hurdle that Graham, I think, very eloquently talked about, which is that in order for us to affect change in medicine, we have to affect change in ourselves and see where our own roadblocks are in terms of how we operate and how the things that we accept as being true are not necessarily so. And that's a difficult thing for people who are smart like we are to accept that. The saying that, you know what we know, and we know what we don't know, but we don't know what we don't know. And a lot of the alternative medicine is in the area of we don't know what we don't know. And that's something that we're all uncomfortable with. But in order to help overcome intractable problems, we have to embrace the unknown. So it's really twofold. It's one is discovery of evidence-based practice and showing that it does improve outcomes. And two, it's willing to accept that there's just a lot we don't know about health and disease, and having an openness to things that take us out of our comfort zone are important to listen to and have an open mind to.
Thank you. Yeah. Jim, as you made this transition, anything that you've observed with your colleagues?
Yeah, I've gotten beaten up a couple of times, but I would say not from anybody who I respect. And from people who I do respect, never for a good reason. And when I've called them on it or talked to them about it, I usually get an apology. Because they did it for the wrong reason or lack of understanding or something. It was very important to me going into this that I not be thought of as a kook. And so I'm very careful about making sure what I do is evidence-based. I mean, that's what we've been taught. And, you know, when I sit down and have the thoughtful discussion with my colleagues who are not necessarily on the same page, I can usually prove to them that what they're doing is not the best medicine on the basis of evidence. So I would say I haven't yet had the experience where I was beaten up for the right reasons. And I'm hopeful. I've been talking to, you know, in Orange County, they have this Lipid Alliance, which is, they have a yearly conference. And a year or two ago, I went to the conference. It's a one-day conference. And there was a lifestyle medicine lecture that was terrible, frankly. And so I've been talking with one of the two organizers of the conference. Hopefully, I'll be able to give the Lifestyle Medicine Conference to a room full of mostly cardiologists and primary care physicians to tell them what the truth is and what they need to know based on the evidence, which is what they're there to hear.
And you have a pretty good referral practice with Hoag, right? With Hoag Hospital, which is really one of the big medical centers in the area.
Yes. That's essentially the only hospital that I use for my patients.
And have you had reasonable acceptance when you go and you do your visits there with the staff and the people that know you're doing a little bit of this kind of medicine?
Honestly, I really transitioned my practice, and I do very little inpatient work now. You know, there's this wonderful thing called intensivists and hospitalists, and they get woken up at night, and I don't get woken up anymore. So I haven't had that experience because I really don't do that much anymore.
Great. Ken, any thoughts about your transition with your peers? If you want to call them peers, members of the community.
Colleagues. Well, looking back, the primary care physicians in town kind of look like over the paper to see, because they're kind of interested in what we're doing, because they hear things from patients. The high school teacher that you talked about earlier, his brother is a well-known family practice doc in town.
Wow.
In town. So I tried to reach out to my fellow primary care physicians and say, I don't need more clinical patients, but I'd love to take care of those metabolic syndrome or type 2 diabetic patients that you don't necessarily want to. And what I finally realized, they didn't do it because they were fearful that they'd lose their patients. Because, as I mentioned earlier, our office is a beautiful 1902 heritage house with a big wraparound porch. And when people walk around there, they're going to go, why do I need to go anyplace else? You know, the staff treats them well. So I got over that. Recently, was invited to a hospital, it wasn't a staff meeting, but it was sponsored by the hospital. There was interventional cardiologist, some vascular surgeons, and a handful of family docs. And it was about peripheral artery disease and doing PADNET screens. So they all went and said their piece, and one of the cardiologists says, let's ask Browning what he does, because he does things a little bit different. Well, fortunately, I've been preparing to go speak up in Grants Pass, Oregon, so I had all my stats ready to go, and I, probably 15 minutes, it was just, I was doing it, and I felt really good about it, and I told him why we are different, and shouldn't we be treating the whole person, and my server came up to me when she was giving me another glass of wine, she goes, great talk. So I thought, that was very cool. Then my other encounter was with another cardiologist at the hospital. The hospital does ask us to speak often to employee group meetings or luncheons and things like that. So we have picked up a lot of the ER nurses. We've picked up a lot of the cath lab nurses and management nurses. They come to us and they get better. So we're trying to worm our way into the hospital to do similar, I think, to what you're doing. But this cardiologist got up and spoke after we had spoken, and he says, you know, I could sit here and tell you, as a cardiologist, you need to quit smoking and you need to eat better, but if you really want to get well, go see Dr. Browning.
Oh, my word. Wow.
So that was like, and that was unsolicited, and it was like, whoa. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
They do recognize in a community.
Sorry?
They do recognize when
yes.
you do good, respectable
yes.
work in the community. As long as you're not bad-mouthing them, why aren't they doing it? You know,
we just stay hunkered down in our place, you know, taking care of people.
Christy, how about you as a naturopathic physician in a that's Mayo territory up there? So, what's been the general sense that you've seen?
I am just starting my 14th year in private practice. So the first 5 to 6 years, the focus was on the patient, not as much the healthcare community, because most of the healthcare providers had never heard of a naturopathic physician where I lived. I was the sixth in our entire state. So it was back in 1997. So I let the patients do the talking for me. And after that first 5 year, half decade passed, all of a sudden the results that the patients were getting under the care of other physicians for 10, 20, 30, 40 years was really what opened the door for me. And so in my own personal community, I allowed for the patient results and the patients to really carry the message for me. I continue to focus on the patient, their goals, their needs, and do patient education. A lot of community education, patient education, and as you pointed out, a lot of my first past patients, when I look back to my first few years, they were nurses. They were not physicians, but they were other healthcare providers in the system who worked in the system and knew the system was broken, as they would say, and coming and looking for other issues. So I would say the community breaking through hasn't been nearly as challenging as speaking on this topic to medical doctors, to osteopathic practitioners, to multidisciplinary practitioners, and having my own naturopathic providers say, what are you doing teaching naturopathic medicine to the other guys? That has probably been one of the most interesting journeys I have gone through, because as many of you know, functional medicine has some very strong naturopathic principles within it, and naturopaths do lifestyle medicine. That's what you spend your 4 years of medical school focusing on, is all lifestyle medicine. So my skin has had to get a little bit thicker. I've had to toughen up more against my own team, I would say, because they want to know, what am I doing out there teaching them all of the secrets? And I just look back and say, why would you not want to empower every physician to just go back and transform one patient? Just one patient's life with a little something you had to say. And so I'm taking the high road on this one. I truly believe that some of the key foundational principles on docere means teacher. You teach the patient, you teach the doctors, you teach the community, and from there, they're going to pay it forward.
Thank you. Really nice model. So Mark, clearly in your academic environment, maybe the swirling guild is a little bit tighter, I don't know. Have you experienced any kind of interesting conversations with your colleagues about this whole model?
I think one of the major things is that the concept of teamwork has now become so clear, meaning that we as physicians essentially dictate to our patients, but now the conversations that we've had is that, you know, really if you're going to have an impact on patients, it really takes a whole team. And as you mentioned, your life educator, your nutritionist, I mean, they're the ones who are in there day in and day out and really doing the motivational interview and helping patients change behaviors and really empowering them as well. But, you know, likewise, here the patients themselves, there are some group settings that we utilize, and well, other patients are tremendous assets to each other. And they quite often learn a lot more from other patients than they will learn from me as a physician. I've heard that quite, you know, amongst our physicians as well. And the families, they can have a very positive role. If, you know, there's a mother who's trying to change behaviors, that eat correctly, she needs the support of her husband as well as her children, and she doesn't have that support. So I'm just a small piece, as, you know, we as physicians and clinicians, we're just a small piece of the whole pie that we're developing. And likewise, the researchers are in the background who give us the real tools to help change behaviors and to have an impact. So, you know, that's it. Teamwork. I really think that's where...
That's a really nice message. So I want to ask one quick question. This is going to be a soundbite. I'd like you to each think about this. I'm going to give you a magic wand, and I'm going to give you one wish to be realized, granted, for the successful implementation of improved patient outcome in your practices with chronic ill patients. What would it be? And this would be your soundbite wish. David?
I don't understand the question, so...
Okay, so let me give it to you again.
Okay.
If you could be granted one wish to make your patient population more successful than they are today in outcome, what would it be?
Well, I still don't really think I understand the question, but I will...
You can frame the question any way you want. You can answer it any way you'd like to frame it.
What I have found, the most important thing when I see transformational change in my patients is that I have the faith to create a context where I don't have the answer. Where I walk into a room and I just simply let the answer emerge, because I come with a lot of information. I come with a lot of knowledge. I have a certain architecture I use for sorting that. But to actually go into a room and create a context where something happens between that emerges from us just talking and listening, where I'm not the answer man, where I let that one go and have the faith that something will emerge that will change my life while it's changing their life. That's the hardest thing for me, because my training is that the buck stops here, that I have to somehow play 62 card pickup until I pick up the right card. And that's going to be, I'm a good doctor if I figure out which card it is. And it's not like that. It actually, the big things where the walls fall down and something magical happens is where I'm just there. I just happen to be a witness of what's happening. And to have the faith that that will happen and not get into that thing where my reputation, I don't want to be embarrassed, all those things. That I just simply say, together we're going to find an answer. And I may have some of that. I know that you're probably the one that's going to come up with an answer. And we're just going to have a dialogue here until we figure this out. And then something happens. And when I get in the way, a patient comes back a couple of times, and I'll say, I just can't figure this out, so I'm going to step out of the room, and I'm going to ask Dr. Brown to come in the room. And then you explain to Dr. Brown what Dr. Jones doesn't know.
And I'll come back in the room and say, well, Dr. Jones sent me here. And every time the patient within 2 minutes tells me what the answer is. Creating that context where something like that can happen has become probably one of the greatest joys, because it's like I don't have to carry that heavy responsibility, that mantle that I was given. When I finished medical school, they put a mantle. I got a mantle. It was a green sash. Now I'm the answer man. I don't have to do that if I have enough faith that if I let it happen, it will happen.
So let me make an observation. First of all, you did answer my question, yes, because what I take away from your response is that if you have this wish granted, what you would do is wish that the context of healing was established in every interrelationship you had in that privileged moment of the exam treatment room.
That's what I've always loved about you, is that I can say something and then you can translate it.
Well, and vice versa. And you also said something else that I want to really emphasize for the group and for this discussion, and that is the abilities that you have and your colleagues here at this table that are all masters in their areas to establish context is deeply studied and developed. It didn't just happen magically. This isn't like some kind of a divine process where you spiritually came down from the mountain and you suddenly had the wisdom to create the context. All the things that you've done throughout your career in your personal life create then the environment for establishing the potential context for many different people to have that experience, right? And so I think that this concept of deep training, that we don't know exactly where it takes us, and the architecture of learning and the constant pursuit of wisdom and all those things that go into I don't know the answers that keeps driving you creates a context that is an expanding context for the opportunity for healing, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really what Osler was talking about in his writings about really great medicine. So,
well, two or three people around the table have talked about the sacred nature of what we do. And for me, that sacred nature is where something emerges between the two of us. And it's sacred. But I didn't do it.
No. But you prepared the soil.
I may have prepared the soil, but mainly I get the hell out of the way.
Okay. So, Graham, you got your magic wand. Anything that you would say would be what you'd like to have to complete the circle?
Yeah, I was saying to some before we started the evening that I turned 74 in November, and I've got so much more energy than anybody I know much at 74, I think. I'm just kind of getting started on a whole lot of this. And I have a lot of phrases I use with patients a lot. For instance, I say, my job is to teach you, not to need me. So I'm busy helping you do this. I'm doing techniques and studies and lab studies, and I do a blood count. So in 1 minute I know, do you have a virus or a bacteria? And I'm not going to give you an antibiotic. But in case you don't, this is what we're going to do. You check the CBC. If it's 3,000, you don't have that. If it's 15,000, you do. Now, you'll know in the future that we'll start with a vitamin C. You'll be on the vitamin C, 3,000 three times a day for 3 days. And then if indeed you are still sick and really puffy, then I will help you with this antibiotic. And if you don't come back again, you don't need to come back if you don't need to get the antibiotic, but if you do take the antibiotic, I'll check it for. So we empower the mind and we teach you not to need it. The second thing is I need to be present to the moment. When you give me a call, I give all my patients my cell number. Everyone. All my coaches, everyone has my cell number. I maybe once a month have a violator. A total week, I might get 7-8 phone calls. Total. That's a gift. Partly because they feel free to call and they don't want to interrupt me because they know there's other people that they set the waiting room with. But then me and I set up the staff say, be present to the very thing we just talked about this morning, to the present to the sacred invasion of their lives. I love the phrase invasion. I love the word sacred. It is a sacred and it's a hallowed moment. Mm-hmm. I want to honor them. And then I want to help them discover the multiplicity of their diverse gifts, because they have many gifts, for instance. And I want to broaden their life spiritually, to find and move their life to being full, to being fulfilled. What would help you be fulfilled? And so,
okay, Jay.
I'll be very succinct, and just to paraphrase a French philosopher, be to grant the potential for consciousness to jump over its own shadow.
Oh, that's really powerful.
Wow. Say it again.
That's powerful.
To grant the potential for consciousness to jump over its own shadow.
That's a wonderful quote, man.
I don't know if I can follow. So, for me, the question is, what? What do I do? Doc, what do I do? And I always say, more important than the what is the why. So for me, it comes down to education. It's very important to educate people why they should do what we've been talking about. Because once they understand that, then the what is easy for them to be compliant with. So if I had my magic wand, it would be to know what that hook is for each patient before I walk into that encounter.
Thank you.
Ken?
The hook is the word I use too, but for me, the magic wand, for me, is to take all of the data, the communication, and be able to process that in concisely, or even have it make sense, give it back to the patient in a way that they get it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
So if I had the magic wand, I live in the middle of an agricultural hub in the middle of Minnesota, so I would say, since my principle is food first, I would want clean, colorful, affordable food. Mm. Because that would reach everybody. And I think that would do my patient population the greatest good.
Thank you. Beautiful. Mark, you can round this out. We'll run into the stretch.
Hard to follow all these wonderful comments, but I think I'd want to have the wand sort of restating the ability to listen. And it's not only to the patient, but also to the community in which they're in. You know, when you're working sometimes in the environments I am, in the emergency room, for example, you have your hand on the pulse of the patient, but you also have your hand on the pulse of the community, what's going on in that community, and also the corporate environment as well. All of those are interacting together to impact the health of our patients. So I need to be able to listen to all those inputs and to synthesize those in a way that can actually help the patient. So that's the one I'd like to have.
Well, thank you. We obviously way exceeded the hour that I said we were going to have, but I should have known that with this group of deep thinkers and experienced souls. This has been a privilege. David, Graham, Jay, Jim, the two of the Brownings, Christy, Mark, thanks. This has really been one of those magic moments. We often don't get this chance. This is like the great circle that probably Chautauquas were built around, right, with the Indian tradition of great sharing. So thanks. This will be shared with many other people, and I hope it will be as inspirational for them as it has been for me. So thank you very much. Peace be with you.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed part two of this visit with our experts as much as I have. You can tell just by my tone of voice when I was engaged in the discussion with them how moved and impacted I was by the dedication and seriousness and soulful energy and expertise that these individuals have brought into their work, and the benefit undoubtedly that that has with the connection they have with their patients and ultimately the effectiveness of outcome of these personalized lifestyle medicine programs in their practices. These are real role models for me in really reminding of the sacredness of the work that we do, this important role that we have in serving as a guide, teacher, mentor, connector of patients that have been aspiring to improve their health and maybe been on a search that has not been totally successful for finding the right answers to their own individual questions. I think that we can see, as we started off, that this looming elephant, not just in the corner, it's actually a herd of elephants that we call the $47 trillion burden over the next 20 years for managing non-communicable chronic disease, has a potential resonance for solution within this personalized lifestyle medicine, functional medicine-based approach, a patient-centered approach. It, to me, is mirroring what's happening in the basic sciences and the basic clinical work that's going on with intervention, along with an unmet need for finding a new solution to this rising tide of chronic disease. The solution will not have come solely from the development of a new drug or a new family of drugs. It's going to come from a complex accessing of this revolutionary information of nutrigenomics and epigenetics and systems biology and how that interrelates with the emergence of a health pattern from the genes of resistance to environmental stress versus a defensive response that we call inflammation and a body then being locked into the homeostasis of chronic illness. These approaches that we've been describing on functional medicine over these many decades now are really kind of the front edge of how this field is evolving, how it's morphing, how it's changing. And this two-part series with our clinician experts who have been doing this in their practice and trying to kind of work upstream often against the way that medicine was trained to them to be done is a testament, I think, to the fact that we can forge ahead often against great odds to innovate and develop new ways of approaching complicated problems that have seemed insoluble. I've read recently the books by Clayton Christensen on Innovator's Dilemma and Innovator's Prescription, two books that he's authored, which really talk about this concept of disruptive technology, that disruptive technology is that which is a shifting paradigm, to use Thomas Kuhn's Structure and Scientific Revolutions word, that the shifting paradigm is a non-linear break in the way we think about certain things that have come originally as outlier thoughts that are disruptive, that are resisted, that are seen to be not consistent with the body of knowledge of the day. And yet somehow they catch with a few, ultimately are tested in the cauldron of life, become more robust and more well understood, and then if they have staying power, if they have translational ability, they ultimately penetrate through barriers of restriction to become the new thought, the new paradigm. And that disruptive technology that we're seeing develop today in healthcare, to me, is where the solutions to these problems in the future will lie. I don't believe that we're going to see the solutions to the increasing burden of chronic disease come out of development of the next better drug, the next statin, or the next antihypertensive, or the next antidiabetic. I believe that the burden of the proof of concept and ultimately the paradigm shift will come out of this interface that I'm talking about, of interface of understanding between genes and environment and personalized response. It'll certainly see its way in cardiovascular disease and diabetes, but it may see its way first in this whole nature of the rising tide of dementia and Alzheimer's-like disease with mental health problems, because there is an area where you can measure fairly rapidly the outcome. The endpoints are fairly easily measured inexpensively, and the studies can be done in a fairly short term. I look forward to exploring this topic in much greater detail with you as we move on in Functional Medicine Update, because I think that's the front edge of how we might actually measure the improvement in quality-adjusted life years and look at cost-effectiveness of this type of personalized lifestyle medicine intervention. Thanks for being with us for this two-part series on the whole concept of lifestyle medicine. We'll be exploring this in greater detail as we move forward.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form other than for personal use is prohibited.